Continuing. The socialist solution to the Marxian crisis fails because it doesn't get at the root of the problem, which is not the private ownership of property, but rather the concept of property to begin with. And the concept of property, as we have seen, itself depends on our definition of ourselves and the way we understand the world. Greed, competition, anxiety, and scarcity are built into our cosmology and our science, and will not go away until and unless the other pieces of the pattern change as well. Specifically, they will not go away when we see the world, nature, language, thought, and ideas as things that can be cordoned off and owned as objects. The characteristics of capital upon which Marx based his theory stem from the characteristics of the money system that currently dominates, which features a scarce interest-bearing currency created by banks. Very different economic dynamics would result from a money system with different characteristics, and a different money system will spring forth naturally from a different understanding of and relationship to the world. A very different form of capitalism will then emerge, to which Marx's dynamics do not apply, which fosters cooperation over competition, sharing over exploitation, community over separation, in other words, which values and develops all the non-monetary forms of wealth described herein. It will be a system that makes us richer in life rather than poorer in life, but richer in money. And significantly, it will be a system that is not designed in the usual sense, but which is allowed to grow. This is the true revolution, not a superficial overthrow of whatever powers happen to be, but a radically new understanding of self and world. Marx criticized the bourgeois revolutions of America and France for merely replacing one set of owners with another. Yet isn't his own revolution similarly shallow, leaving untouched the concept of property, the duality of labor and leisure, the ideology of growth, and the assumption of human domination over nature? Why is such a deep revolution necessary? The history of technology, at least back to agriculture and probably back to the pre-human technologies of fire and stone, is closely linked to an increasing objectification of the world. We conceptually separate ourselves from the environment in order to manipulate it. Equally, our successful manipulation of the environment spurs our conceptual separation from it. The concept of property naturally flows out of such an objectification, and the kind of money we have today arises naturally out of such property, which is mine and not yours, which can be accumulated and measured. It is foolish to think that any system other than the capitalism we are familiar with could arise from such a prior foundation. A revolution that leaves our conceptualization of self and world intact cannot bring other than temporary superficial change. Only a much deeper revolution, a reconceiving of who we are, can reverse the crises of our age. Fortunately, to use the language of Marx, this deepest of all possible revolutions is inevitable, and it is inevitable precisely for the reasons Marx foresaw. The conversion of all other capital into money is unsustainable. Someday it will run out. As it does, our impoverishment will deepen. Misery and desperation will overcome whatever measures can be invented to suppress or narcotize them. When at last the futility of controlling reality becomes apparent, when at last the burden of maintaining an artificial self separate from nature becomes too heavy to bear any longer, when at last we realize that our wealth has bankrupted us of life, then a million tiny revolutions will converge into a vast planetary shift, a rapid phase transition into a new mode of being. It will happen, must happen, perhaps sooner than we think. Indeed, it is already happening. Our social, natural, cultural, and spiritual capital is almost exhausted. Their depletion is generating crises in all realms of modern life, crises which are seemingly unconnected, except that they all arise from the monetization of life, or underneath that, from our fundamental confusion as to who we are, our separation from nature, ourselves and each other. This is the link that connects such disparate phenomena as peak oil, the autoimmune disease epidemic, global warming, forest death, fishery depletion, the crisis in education, and the impending food crisis. Both monetization and separation are nearing their maxima, their greatest possible extremes. The former is in the completion of the conversion of common wealth into private wealth that I have described in this chapter. The latter is in the complete sense of isolation and alienation implicit in the world of Darwin and Descartes. The naked material self in a world forged by chance and determinism, where purpose, meaning, and God are, by the nature of reality, nothing more than self-delusory figments of the imagination. Paradoxically, it is in the fulfillment of these extremes, each of which is a cause and an aspect of the other, that their opposites are born. Yang, having reached his extreme, gives birth to yin. The depletion of social capital launches a revolution that will reclaim it. The agony of separation bursts a surrender that opens us to a larger version of the self, to nature, and to life. But the extremum must be reached. As any environmental scientist knows, it is certain that things will get much, much worse for the bulk of humanity before they get any better. Certain forces must play themselves out. The momentous rise in spiritual, humanitarian, and ecological awareness will not save us. Not because it is too late, though it is, but because the course of separation has not yet reached its finale. Like an alcoholic whose resources of goodwill, money, pawnable assets, friends, and credibility are almost exhausted, our way of life is on the verge of collapse. We continue to scramble, applying new technological fixes at a greater and greater cost to alleviate the problems caused by the last fix. The addict will keep on using until life becomes completely unmanageable. Ecological awareness, localism, green design, herbalism, community currencies, ecology-based economics are all like the drunk's moments of clarity on the way down. They will not so much save us as serve as the seeds for a new way of living and being that we will adopt after the collapse. Indeed, they will all come naturally as a matter of course, if there is anything left at all. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 4, Money and Property, from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition, by Charles Eisenstein.
Put a light in the window, your brother's coming home. Set a meal on the table, your brother's coming home. He'll be tired and weary after all these years alone. He's coming home, your brother's coming home. Take the chain from the door, your sister's coming home. Open wide your arms, your sister's coming home. Don't leave her standing there after all the pain she's known. She's coming home, your sister's coming home. Coming home to a place they've never been. Coming home to a land they've never seen. Coming home to a family they have never known. All joy been angry and afraid. Your father's coming home. He's been hounded and betrayed. Your father's coming home. And with every act of kindness, a seed of hope is sown. He's coming home. your father's coming home. Coming home to a place they've never been. Coming home to a land they've never seen. Coming home to a family they have never known. Oh, Job Thompson's bays are coming home. Bring her in from the cold. Your mother's coming home. Set her down by the fire. Your mother's coming home. Make her warm, make her welcome. Before the chance is gone, she's coming home. Your mother's coming home. Coming home to a place they've never been. Coming home to a land they've never seen. Coming home to a family they have never known. Oh, Job Thompson's hands are coming home. From Iraq and Zimbabwe, your family's coming home. And from Turkey and Somalia, your family's coming home. Seeking rest and refuge they have never known. They're coming home. Your family's coming home. Coming home to the place they've never been. Coming home.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Banner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. And so now continuing with the next chapter in Ascent of Humanity, Chapter 5, The World Under Control, The Total Depravity of Man. Starting with the earliest technologies of fire, stone shaping, and symbolic culture, the ascent of humanity is a history of ever greater control over nature and human nature. Its culmination would be to make that control complete. Although most people no longer think it possible to win a complete victory over disease, suffering, and death, that is a complete victory over nature. The technological program lives on in unspoken assumptions and attitudes, the dream of a technological utopia. Life will get better and better, safer and safer, more and more convenient, efficient, modern, clean, automated, secure. Underlying this belief is the assumption that we are on the right track and indeed that we have come a long way already. It assumes that life in the raw is, as Thomas Hobbes so famously put it, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. The tenacity with which we cling to this prejudice reveals just how much depends on it, nothing less than the whole ideology of progress. Progress, in the sense we know it, is only meaningful if we are ascending from a lower to a higher state, from the natural realm to a separate human realm. Extrapolating backward, we must believe that original nature and original human nature are bad. Hence the goal of control. Technology to control nature, culture to control human nature. This chapter will outline the all-encompassing consequences of the program of bringing life in the world under control. While collectively we seek to dominate and subdue nature through science and technology, the goal of control casts a shadow into our personal lives as well. We feel we need to control ourselves, our body, our emotions, our impulses, our appetites. Why? Because in a personalized version of the Hobbesian view of nature, our natural selves are bad, too. The psychological technologies we use to achieve self-control are legion, internalized from earliest childhood. Guilt, willpower, discipline, shame, motivations, threats, rewards. We must govern and control ourselves, just as we must govern and control nature through technology to make it good, an ordered garden as opposed to an inhospitable wilderness. Indeed, as the uncivilized human is in a state of nature, the two statements of inherent badness, of wild nature and the uncontrolled human, are identical. In religion, this assumption is embodied in the concept of original sin, and more broadly, the idea found across all institutionalized religions that spirituality consists of a struggle at self-improvement. We strive to raise ourselves above the temptations of the flesh into the realm of the spirit, to overcome our bestial inclinations, to exercise restraint and self-control. In other words, we hold ourselves to a code of morality. Whether it is Hinduism, Christianity, or any other world religion, it is a basic doctrine that we should try hard to be nice. The same applies, perhaps even more strongly, to ethical and moral systems that are not explicitly religious. Another indication that the seeming cultural divide in our society between the secular and the religious is mostly a matter of appearances. The idea of original sin is central to most Christian churches today, although it was once hotly disputed by such church fathers as Pelagius and fudged by later figures such as Thomas Aquinas. The founders of Protestantism, Martin Luther and John Calvin, argued for the total depravity of man, the innate sinfulness of human beings. For them, trying hard to be nice wasn't good enough. This is a crucial doctrine because it is the foundation of the entire dogma of Christ as the supernatural Redeemer, an agent of divinity outside ourselves, our one and only salvation. Also, as Abraham Maslow observes, quote, any doctrine of the innate depravity of man or any maligning of his animal nature very easily leads to some extra-human interpretation of goodness, saintliness, virtue, self-sacrifice, altruism, etc. If they can't be explained from within human nature, and explained they must be, then they must be explained from outside of human nature. The worse man is, the poorer a thing he is conceived to be, the more necessary becomes a god. Close quote. It is not just religion that depends on the innate depravity of the human species. The doctrine extends beyond theology to atheistic psychology. Most famously in the writings of Sigmund Freud, but more recently, in works of various Darwinian sociobiologists and cognitive psychologists, such as Richard Dawkins and Steven Pinker. Here is a revealing irony. Though Protestant fundamentalists vilify Darwinism and seek to keep it out of the public schools, their view of the innate sinfulness of man is in complete agreement with the neo-Darwinian account of life's origins and evolution. Each dovetails beautifully with the other. This should come as no surprise, since both Darwinism and original sin arise out of the same deep cultural conceptions of self and the universe. The nature implicit in Darwinism, including human nature, is not very nice. It is a nature in which competition is the rule, in which the deepest purpose of life, the deepest motivation of behavior, is to survive and reproduce, and in which cooperation is an occasional coincidental product of an alignment of interests. Cooperation is okay, but it is even better to trick other organisms into helping you, while you refrain from expending any energy helping them. As Richard Dawkins writes, quote, natural selection favors genes which control their survival machines in such a way that they make the best use of their environment. This includes making the best use of other survival machines, both of the same and different species, close quote. The definition of the self, implicit in the dominant theories of biogenesis and evolution, is that each of us is a discrete, separate being struggling against other such beings to survive and reproduce. In this view, from the unicellular stage to the present, successful organisms are those that are better able to look after their own interests at the expense of their rivals, a rival being defined as anything competing for the same resources. Any organism programmed by its genes to enact behaviors that diminish its chances of surviving and reproducing, for example, sharing resources when there may not be enough for itself, is less likely to reproduce, and those genes will die out of the gene pool. In other words, we are programmed, life is programmed, to profit at the expense of other beings. Can you think of a better definition of not nice than that? Selfishness being our nature, of course, we need laws, morals, and self-control to rein in that selfishness and become civil beings. Thus, mainstream science and mainstream religion agree that we are by nature bad. And therefore, just as we must control nature, we must control, regulate, improve upon, and yes, dominate ourselves in order that we may be good. Let us add to this agreement economics, which also holds as a central axiom that people are driven to maximize self-interest. If science, religion, and economics all agree, the doctrine of innate badness must have deep roots indeed. It is no accident that it is orthodoxy in both the scientific and religious realms. The ideology of our civilization, progress, ascent, depends on it. It is therefore built into many of our reflexive assumptions of what is true. It is also built into our money system, thus generating the very same behavior that we mistake as fundamental. Because it is imbued so deeply into our mythology, our ideology, our culture, and our economy, the doctrine of original sin is actually correct. Correct insofar as we are immersed in our culture. It is correct given our ideological infrastructure and the motivations built into our cultural institutions. Hobbes wrote Leviathan long before Darwin ever conceived of evolution via natural selection, and long before the theory of the selfish gene was ever invented. The human nature is bad idea goes back way before Darwin, before Hobbes, before Luther and Calvin. It is implicit in dualism itself, which finds its origin in the so-called Neolithic Revolution, if not before, even if its full articulation was not to come until the Scientific Revolution. Dualism is the idea that the universe is divided into two parts, which go by the names of matter and spirit, God and creation, human and nature, or most fundamentally, self and other. These two parts are by no means symmetrical. Self is more important, other less. In religion, soul is self, body is other. The soul is important, while the flesh is at best irrelevant and at worst an impediment to the life of the spirit. Outside religion, the same dualism following Descartes manifests itself as mind equals self, body equals other. Either way, we identify with our minds and not our bodies, not other life forms, not the world at large. Even if we try hard to cultivate compassion, a narrow identity with an illusory separate self is built into our deepest worldview. In fact, that we feel we need to try to be compassionate is symptomatic of that worldview. No wonder we are so out of touch with our bodies and suffer such chronically poor health. No wonder we treat our bodies and our material planet so cavalierly. No wonder we visit such violence on these unimportant others, other religions, other nations, other races, other species. On a collective level, dualism manifests as a distinction between man and nature, once again dividing the universe into two parts, one of which is self and therefore important, the other of which is other, and thus only important to the extent that it affects self. Dualism motivates well-meaning arguments for conservation of natural resources, locutions which imply the subordination of nature to man and define the things of the world in terms of their usefulness to ourselves. Rainforests are to be preserved because, who knows, we might derive important medicines from them someday. And just imagine the economic losses from topsoil erosion. Such arguments are counterproductive because they end up reinforcing the very mindset that is at the root of the problem to begin with, that the world is other, here for our use. The logical conclusion of dualism, that other is important only to the extent it affects self, is a hidden abscess constantly leaking poison into the body of our civilization. It is a universal acid that erodes away the core of any system of morals, ethics, and responsibility, which readily succumb to a succession of pragmatic why should I's. Accepting pragmatic reasons, why should I care about anything outside myself? The usual religious answer, because God says to, or because God will punish me otherwise, gets us nowhere, because that morality too comes down to pragmatism. Avoiding divine retribution for our sins, it is really no different. Must we be scared into being good? Must we exercise self-control, knowing that we are foregoing our natural self-interest that we could maximize by being ruthless to the world? Is eternal struggle the only alternative to depravity? Why should I, as an individual, do anything for anyone else? Why shouldn't I pollute to my heart's content? Why shouldn't I steal your wallet, provided I know I can get away with it? Here is a dialogue I recently had with my class. Me. Why shouldn't I just pollute as I want to? Class. You might poison your own environment. Me. Yes, you're right. I'd better make sure only to pollute my neighbor's yards, not my own. Class. If you get caught, you'll suffer consequences that outweigh the benefits of polluting. Me. Okay. I will only pollute to the extent that the benefits outweigh the risks. I'll do it in secret while maintaining the appearance of being a nice guy. I'll get an unscrupulous business to pay me cash to dump toxic waste into a sinkhole at night. No one will ever know. Or let's say I'm a corporation and I want to pollute to maintain higher profits. I'll fund biased studies and create PR that says pollution isn't so bad after all. Why shouldn't I? Class. Because if everyone did that, you would be doomed. Me, true. That's why I support laws and morals that prevent others from doing it. But why shouldn't I do it myself if I can get away from it? Why shouldn't I manipulate other survival machines, both of the same and different species? In other words, what does the rest of the world matter? The discrete and isolated self of Descartes implies a discrete and separate universe outside that self. As long as I can insulate myself from the world out there, possible in principle, precisely because it is separate, I can do anything I want to. The only limits are pragmatic ones. On a case-by-case basis, I can judge whether each action maximizes my benefit. Should I steal that man's wallet he left on the table when he went to the bathroom? Let me calculate the costs and benefits. The potential payoff is $200. The risk of getting caught in this setting is only about 2%. The fine and loss of face is worth maybe $7,000. Calculating. I arrive at an expected payoff of $56. That is $200 times 98% minus $7,000 times 2%. So I steal it. Raise the fine to $11,000, and I won't, right? The logic seems absurd, but it is precisely the logic behind a legal system based on deterrence. This system seeks, through the imposition of penalties, to convert behavior that would otherwise be in an individual's rational self-interest into irrational behavior. Without a penalty of some sort, stealing would be in our rational self-interest. Let us pursue this line of inquiry a little further. Everyone knows that we don't actually perform an explicit calculation every time the opportunity to profit at another's expense presents itself. The decision has been automated through the moral training of our childhood. Our parents, teachers, and other authorities train us not to be selfish by rewarding nice behavior and punishing selfish behavior. They provide an incentive for niceness that makes it no longer irrational but actually in line with selfishness. Eventually, we internalize these incentives in the form of guilt, conscience, and habit. Our natural selves are selfish, ruthless, and depraved, requiring a long period of training to subdue nature and foster morals, ethics, and decent behavior. Here we see an inextricable link between dualism and control. Bereft of an organic indwelling spirit, the material world that science presents us, indifferent, purposeless, and ruthlessly competitive, cries out for the control we call technology. Ruled by bestial or sinful drives, the physical body living in that world similarly calls out for the control we impose through moral training, education, and culture. The program of control, in turn, demands the reduction of the world described in the Origins of Separation, that is, the finitization of the infinite. In science, we seek to control variables, in engineering, to account for every conceivable force with our equations. Our efforts at control fail when the infinite leaks back in, an uncontrolled variable in science, an unforeseen circumstance in life, human error in a factory. Always, the response to such accidents is to extend control to them too, to make the system fail-safe. Yet after thousands of years, no matter how hard we try, infinity keeps creeping back in. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. The Winners and the Losers. Under the sway of dualism, we have essentially sought to divide the world into two parts, one infinite and the other finite. Then to live wholly in the latter, which, because it is finite, is amenable to control. We are like the frog who jumped into a well, and unable to see anything else or remember the vast world beyond, declared himself suzerain of all the universe. Our lordship over nature is at heart an egregious self-deception, because its first step is to attempt nature's precipitous reduction, which is equally a reduction of life, a reduction of experience, a reduction of feeling, and a reduction of being, a true Faustian exchange of the infinite for the finite. This reduction comes in many guises and goes by many names. It is the domestication of the wild. It is the measuring and quantification of nature. It is the conversion of cultural, natural, social, and spiritual wealth into money. Because it is a reduction of life, violence is its inevitable accompaniment. Actually, I can think of no better definition of violence than the reduction of life. Hence, the rising crescendo of violence that has bled our civilization for thousands of years and approaches its feverish apogee as we conclude the present wholesale destruction of entire species, oceans, ecosystems, languages, cultures, and peoples. From the weeding of a strawberry bed, to the coercion of a child, to the elimination of enemies in the name of national security, the cultivation and control of the world inherently requires violence. Violence is a built-in feature of our worldview. It is implicit in our conception of ourselves as separate beings in a universe of discrete others competing for survival. Moreover, the objectification of other beings, species, people, and the earth itself enables and legitimizes violence toward them. Violence seems not to be violence when it's only a weed, only an animal, only a savage, only an enemy, only a thing. Dehumanization of the victim is a well-known enabling device for torture and genocide. But dehumanization, turning human into object, is just a special case of our off-separation of ourselves from the rest of the world. To the extent that this is an artificial, illusory separation, the root cause of violence becomes clear. It is simply the result of an ignorance of the very deepest kind, that we know not who we are. Thus it was that the great avatars of peace in human history counseled not more self-control, not an intensification of the effort to be nice, but rather a surrender into our true selves, which are not the separate, discrete selves of present-day science and religion. Buddha was suggesting no less when he asked, "What are you?" By people awestruck at his radiance, he answered simply, "I am awake." This is what a human being really is. And Jesus, too, was saying no less when he spoke of God's love. Not for what we might or could be, but for what we truly are. Moses on the mountaintop asked the divine source, "Who shall I say sent me?" The answer, "I am." I am what? Everything and nothing. When you take us apart, that special part of us we call self, soul, spirit, mind, consciousness is not there. Thus we are nothing. When you separate us from any other part of the universe, we are less. Thus we are everything. Because our demarcation of self and other is a false one, the violence we commit upon the other is actually committed upon ourselves. Here again, we find a warning from some of our most venerable spiritual teachings. The doctrine of karma states that the effects of our actions are inescapable, that what we do to others, we do to ourselves. Yet, characteristically, our religious institutions twist it to mean, be good or you will be punished. The golden rule works the same way. Since its original meaning, as you do unto others, so you do unto yourself, is incoherent nonsense to the dualistic mind, we have perverted it into a rule, a standard of behavior to strive toward. Originally, both the doctrine of karma and the golden rule were mere statements of fact based on a different conception of self. The statement, "Love thy neighbor as thyself," Leviticus 19:18, Matthew 22:39, and elsewhere, falls victim to the same dualistic misinterpretation. Instead of a rule, we might construe it as a simple statement of fact. As you love your neighbor, so do you love yourself. Self and neighbor are not actually separate. Jesus was not going around uttering simple moral platitudes. However, as he was speaking to people immersed in the myth of the separate self, it is no wonder that his teachings were immediately misinterpreted and written down in their current form. The prescriptive and proscriptive forms of spiritual teachings, that is, the do's and don'ts, coincide with the institutional interests of the political powers that co-opt all religious movements from the moment of their founders' deaths, if not before. The only way the dualistic mind can grapple with the idea of karma or the golden rule is to assume the existence of an external judge, a cosmic referee who weighs one's actions and metes out the corresponding rewards and punishments. When you and your neighbor are fundamentally separate, there is no intrinsic reason why what you do unto your neighbor should necessarily come back to affect yourselves, especially if you take sufficient precautions. An omniscient God is needed to bring those consequences to you. The idea of God as a separate power external to nature who enforces morality is therefore a crutch for the mind lost in the myth of separateness, a means of understanding the consequences of our treatment of others. As such, the idea of a supernal God might have a salutary effect in the short term, but runs the risk of reinforcing the illusion of separation. That is what happened in most contemporary Christian churches, which treats humanity's trashing of the earth as a secular matter, not one of the utmost spiritual urgency. From the dualistic perspective, what I've heard some Christians say, that there can be no morality without a belief in God, is actually true. If God does not exist, everything is permitted. Otherwise, what is to stop me from doing ill to my neighbor, as long as I take enough precautions? In theory, I can get away with it. We can go ahead and clear-cut the forests. Maybe the consequences won't come back to haunt us, but if they do, we can manage them. This leads again to a world under control. We can get away with treating the world as a resource, a thing, another, as long as we can manage the pragmatic consequences of that. And there is no reason to think we can't. We can do unto the world whatever we like with impunity as long as we are clever enough. This all changes with the understanding that self and world, man and nature, are not truly separate. For then there is no escape. Then any effort at control can only postpone the inevitable. The idea of a separate, omniscient, judging, rewarding, and punishing God mediates this understanding to the dualistic mind. Unfortunately, the dualistic conception of God invariably leads us to think in terms of pleasing God, obeying God's rules, seeking to gain divine rewards, and avoid divine punishments. It leads us, in other words, right back to the regime of control. By creating an artificial cleavage between self and other, the dualism that divides the world into two parts severs us from part of ourselves. It leaves us partial beings. To fill up the incompleteness, we add more and more to ourselves, more property, more material and spiritual baggage, more ego, more self-importance, an expanding territory of self that seeks to subordinate the world by bringing it under control. However, by seeking to own as much of the world as possible, we only exacerbate the alienation from the rest of the universe, whose infinity dwarfs us into insignificance no matter how much we acquire. The inner wound, the loss of our inner connection to nature, is never healed by the accretion of more and more self on the outside. The root of the world crisis is not inherent selfishness or greed that must be overcome. The solution is not to make do with less, sacrifice our best interests, or impose limits on ourselves. These solutions spring from a mentality of scarcity, and it is precisely the mentality of scarcity which is implicit in the quantization and propertization of the world that makes the infinite finite, that motivates us to hoard and accumulate, possess and own, keep and guard, fence and control. Consider the opposite mentality. Quote, "The good things of the world are abundant. There is plenty for everyone. My needs are abundantly provided. I can have my heart's desires." Close quote. Someone living in such a mindset has no need to own, hoard, or control, because after all, there is plenty. Indigenous hunter-gatherer societies amazed their initial visitors with their guileless, open-handed generosity. As Columbus wrote of the Arawak before murdering and enslaving them, quote, "They are so ingenuous and free with all they have, that no one would believe it who has not seen it. Of anything they possess, if it be asked of them, they never say no. On the contrary, they invite you to share it and show as much love as if their hearts went with it." Close quote. Was an intense acculturation process applied to Arawak children in order to override their inherently greedy, selfish natures and impose a desire to share? I doubt it. Intuitively, we describe their behavior as childish, innocent, or guileless, adjectives that suggest that theirs is the original state of the unspoiled human being. Fully immersed in the reality and mentality of abundance, sharing came naturally. When mine is not a concept, sharing is easy. Characteristically, some modern anthropologists try to explain away primitive generosity and gift relationships in terms of economics, costs and benefits to the separate self. Marcel Mauss set the tone in the early 20th century when he tried to analyze gifts as a competitive means to put other under obligation, an idea echoed by modern theorists such as Richard Posner. Both see gift-giving as a means to generate prestige and as a kind of insurance policy in the absence of accumulative mechanisms in primitive societies. If I give a gift to you, you owe me one. While such motives undoubtedly exist, to see them as primary is to project our own cultural biases. Such ideological contortions are necessary to preserve the assumptions upon which they rest, our civilization's understanding of self and world. From the perspective of the discrete and separate self, altruism simply does not make sense unless some transactional model can reduce it to selfishness in disguise. Derek Jensen describes Ruth Benedict's attempt to categorize cultures into good, life-affirming, nonviolent, egalitarian, gentle, friendly, and free from cruelty, harsh punishment, exploitation, jealousy, humiliation, and depression, and bad, violent, aggressive, cruel, warlike, competitive, and hierarchical, and to discover what rule or factor distinguish them. Her conclusion, quote, "The social forms and institutions of non-aggressive cultures positively reinforce acts that benefit the group as a whole, while negatively reinforcing acts and eliminating goals that harm some members of the group. The social forms of aggressive cultures, on the other hand, reward actions that emphasize individual gain, even or especially when that gain harms others in the community." Close quote. So it is not necessary that mine not be a concept, only that social forms and institutions discourage the accumulation of mine. Universal mechanisms of sharing, for instance, obviously make the hoarding of possessions irrational. But before we conclude that we must change our social forms and institutions, it would perhaps behoove us to dig a little deeper and ask, from what basis do these social forms and institutions arise? While hunter-gatherers indeed had intricate mechanisms to maintain an egalitarian society, these social forms arose naturally out of their sense of self, which was still not so rigidly defined as discrete and separate. Possibly the objective outward rules and taboos, Benedict's forms and institutions, only became necessary as the separation of self progressed through the Paleolithic. In any event, we cannot hope to produce ex nihilo new social forms of positive and negative reinforcement in the absence of the proper substructure, a broader, more open sense of the self. We have become confused. Rational self-interest has become the dupe of our culture's perceptions, so that it is neither rational nor in our interest. Our selfish behavior is only superficially so. It actually conflicts with our true best interests. Chief among such behavior is that which ruthlessly maximizes the perceived benefits of the skin-encapsulated ego. Limiting our destructiveness is not a matter of reining in our selfish impulses. It is a matter of understanding who we really are. When we do not know who we are, of course our selfishness cannot benefit our true selves. Hence, the endemic misery in our society, among its winners and losers alike. It would be one thing if, indeed, the world were essentially a competitive arena destined to have winners and losers. We would then be justified in making every effort to be among the winners. The sad truth, though, is that in our societies, the winners are among the biggest losers of all. Now that's a bold statement indeed. Reading it, you may suspect that I am deficient in knowledge or compassion. What are the petty troubles of the rich compared to the horrendous suffering of our culture's victims? What's a little angst or depression next to starvation, destitution, murder, genocide, tyranny, torture, the smashing of cultures, the looting of ecosystems? Surely I must be oblivious to the true magnitude of the horror. The litany of our culture's victims is nearly endless. The indigenous peoples, the poor, the ecosystems that have been sacrificed in the interests of wealth and power. But we could hardly blame the exploiters if the alternative were to be themselves among the victims. Who can blame someone for being good to themselves? If the world is in essence lunch or become lunch, as I once saw ecology defined, then we cannot blame someone for striving to be in the former category. In such a world, an appropriate ethical system would have the winners be as nice as possible to the losers, offering safety nets to the poor, remediation to the environment, limits on how big a winner you can be. This, in essence, is political liberalism, which does not question any fundamental assumptions. In addition, saintly individuals and their imitators might cast themselves among the losers on purpose, even though they could be a winner if they so deigned, thereby demonstrating just how nice they are, refusing to take more than their share, nobly sacrificing their chance to enjoy the rewards of privilege. Of course, unless you actually are a saint, this self-sacrificial mentality eventually generates resentment at those who decide to enjoy the fruits of being a winner, a resentment often apparent in social and environmental activists. But all of this assumes that the winners are really winners, and that is a deception. Our winners have successfully maximized their rational self-interest, only to find the promise of secure happiness betrayed. Do not waste your energy being angry at the rich and powerful. As the Bolsheviks unwittingly demonstrated, nothing much changes even if the rich and powerful are overthrown. Moreover, that anger is in fact counterproductive. Often the hidden message of activist rhetoric is, do not be too good to yourself, or you are bad for being good to yourself. No wonder so many people are turned off. Those who rely on guilt or shame to persuade us to limit our participation in the destruction of the planet and its people are, in a very subtle way, perpetuating some of the deep axioms that drive the destruction in the first place. They are resorting to a form of control, control over an iniquitous human nature. In a subtle way, they reenact and reinforce the same war of conquest that has left the planet in tatters. Another hidden assumption is that the good life, whether we unabashedly pursue it or nobly sacrifice it, is actually a good life. It is not. We are chasing a mirage. We have been tricked, duped into the aggrandizement of a narrow self that ultimately doesn't even exist. The clearest indication of the fraud comes when the program of control temporarily succeeds. Even when all the bases are covered, every eventuality anticipated, even at the very pinnacle of health, wealth, and power, even then an enervating ennui creeps into life, starting with the empty crevices, the moments of boredom, and ultimately spreading to engulf the entirety of existence. Initially deniable, perhaps by intensifying the success, the power of the stimulation, it comes back stronger and stronger until it holds every waking moment in merciless thrall. This is not a new phenomenon, as Lewis Mumford observes, quote, "An Egyptian story reveals the emptiness of a pharaoh's life, in which every desire was too easily satisfied, and time hung with unbearable heaviness on his hands. Desperate, he appealed to his counselors for some relief from his boredom. And one of them put forth a classic suggestion, that he fill a boat with thinly veiled, almost naked girls, who would paddle over the water and sing songs for him. For an hour, the pharaoh's dreadful tedium, to his great delight, was overcome." Close quote. And in Ecclesiastes, we read, quote, I gathered me also silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and of the provinces. I gathered me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, musical instruments, and that of all sorts. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced because of all my labor, and this was my portion from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Close quote. The depredations of our culture in the name of security, ease, and control have created untold misery in this world, and for no good reason. Not only is life at the pinnacle of success infamously devoid of intimacy, community, authenticity, and meaning, but even the security and control to which these have been sacrificed is a sham. For the sake of security, we have shut off real living, and in return, we have received not even security, but only a temporary semblance of it. Imagine how fatuous our attempts at security will seem when one day the multiple crises engendered by the regime of objectification and control converge to engulf us. How pathetic, how futile our locks and gates, insurance and investments, resumes and expertise, when the intrusion of a personal calamity puts the lie to our illusion of control. All the more for the collective global calamities that are already written into our future. To reverse the tide of destruction that has engulfed our living planet, our society, our communities, and our psyches, it will not be enough to try harder to be nice. Religions have enjoined us to that attempt for thousands of years. It hasn't worked. Yet religion and conventional control-based morality concludes that we must try harder yet. We must do even more of what hasn't worked. If that were the only solution, it would be bad news indeed, and the despair of so many activists would be justified. Even if trying harder succeeded, we would be consigned to an eternity of trying, of struggle. Is peace, sustainability, and goodness, individually or for the world, only possible through unending struggle against ourselves? This book proposes another way, a shift of consciousness that will expand our sense of self and thereby change our selfishness into a force for healing. The problem is not selfishness. It is that we misconceive the self. We need not expend superhuman efforts to build a tower to the sky. The sky is all around us already. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. And I'll continue with more next week. However, if you can't wait or wish to know more about Charles Eisenstein, go to www.ascentofhumanity.com. And you can also download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguest.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.